Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
There are many ways that he could have taken care of the mother-in-law without coming with 15 loaded magazines and an assault rifle to a church. I think he came here with a purpose and a mission.
The 26-year-old white man named Devin Patrick Kelly, who allegedly killed 26 people Sunday as they attended church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, had a history of domestic violence. He was court-martialed on charges he repeatedly hit his wife and attacked his baby stepson. But after he was kicked out of the Air Force with a bad conduct discharge, officials failed to report his crimes to a federal database. So Kelly had no problem buying the gun he used on Sunday.
I know there's a lot of questions about the FBI NICS system and how did the person get the weapons. I can tell you that for the four purchases that he made, the NICS system did their required checks, and there was no prohibitive information in the systems that we checked that say that he could not have purchased that firearm.
We'll look at the link between mass shootings and domestic violence with Saraya Chamali, director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project, and with Mariam Kaba, an organizer and educator who works on anti-domestic violence programs. Then, best-selling Chilean writer Isabel Allende, Latin America's most renowned novelist, has a new novel out called In the Midst of Winter.
The final mission of any work of literature is to connect people and to make us understand how other people feel, what other people want. And if I can achieve that in the era of Trump, I have done a lot, actually.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New details have emerged about Sunday's mass shooting at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, which killed 26 people, including children, elderly, and a pregnant woman. The suspected shooter was a 26-year-old white man named Devin Patrick Kelly from New Braunfels, Texas. Kelly enlisted in the U.S. Air Force in 2010. In 2012, he was court-martialed on charges he repeatedly hit, kicked and choked his wife, pointed a loaded gun at her, and attacked his 18-month-old stepson with such force that it broke the toddler's skull. Kelly was confined for a year and then thrown out of the Air Force with a bad conduct discharge in 2014. But on Monday, the Air Force admitted it had failed to report Kelly's domestic violence court-martial to a federal database, meaning Kelly had no problem buying a Ruger AR-556 assault-style rifle at an Academy Sports and Outdoors store in San Antonio, Texas, in 2016. He reportedly used this gun to massacre the 26 people on Sunday. On Monday, authorities also said Kelly appears to have carried out the massacre because of a domestic dispute he had with his mother-in-law, who is a member of the First Baptist Church, but was not present on Sunday. He apparently killed his grandmother-in-law. This is a spokesman for the Texas Department of Public Safety.
One thing everybody wants to know is, why did this happen? It's a senseless crime, but we can tell you that there was a domestic situation going on within this family. The suspect's mother-in-law attended this church. We know that he had made threatening texts from him, and we can't go into details about that domestic situation that is continuing to be vetted and thoroughly investigated. But we want to get that out there, that this was not racially motivated. It wasn't over religious beliefs. There was a domestic situation going on within the family.
On Monday, seven activists from the group Gays Against Guns were arrested during a die-in protest on Capitol Hill to demand stricter gun control. We'll have more on Sunday's shooting massacre after headlines. President Trump met with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Tokyo on Monday, where Trump pressured Abe to buy billions of dollars of U.S.-manufactured weapons. This comes amidst escalating tensions on the Korean Peninsula, which have been largely sparked and intensified by President Trump himself, who's threatened repeatedly to annihilate the entire nation of North Korea. Later on Monday, during a visit to Seoul, South Korea, Trump struck a slightly more diplomatic tone, talking of a potential deal with North Korea, although he did reiterate the U.S. is prepared to use military action against North Korea. Hundreds of South Koreans protested President Trump's visit on Monday. The United Nations said Monday 2017 will be among the hottest years on record. The announcement came as nearly 200 countries gathered in Bonn, Germany, for the beginning of this year's UN Climate Summit. This is the UN Secretary General, or the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Petteri Talas.
If we are successful in implementation of Paris Agreement, around 2060s, we could see phase out of this. But if not, of course, this negative trend will continue even for thousands of years. So the lifetime of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is very long. So that's why we have to turn this emission evolution during the coming couple of decades to be able to see this phase out. So that's why these COP meetings are so critical at the moment.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is attempting to defend himself after a trove of 13.4 million leaked documents known as the Paradise Papers revealed he continued to conduct business with Vladimir Putin's son-in-law through a shipping company, even after Ross became Trump's Commerce Secretary.
Our client, Sibor, itself, was not then sanctioned, is not now sanctioned, and never was sanctioned in between. So there's nothing whatsoever improper about Navigator having a relationship with Sibor. I don't know any of those individuals, have never met them, certainly not had any commercial dealings with them.
Apple is also under fire after the Paradise Papers revealed aggressive tax evasion by the corporation has allowed it to avoid paying taxes on billions of dollars. The Paradise Papers also implicate more than a dozen of President Trump's cabinet members, advisors and major donors, as well as the Queen of England's estate and the companies Nike, Facebook and Twitter. Tensions are escalating sharply between Saudi Arabia and Iran after Houthi rebels in Yemen launched a ballistic missile toward the Saudi capital, Riyadh, over the weekend. On Monday, Saudi Arabia said the missile launch constituted an act of war by Iran. The Saudis accuse Iran of backing Yemen's Houthi rebels. Saudi Arabia's accusation escalates the possibility of a direct military confrontation between the two regional powers. This comes as at least 11 top Saudi elites and officials were arrested in a widening crackdown aimed at consolidating the power of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's been presiding over the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen. Back in the United States, as part of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown, the federal government's announced it's ending the temporary protected status of thousands of Nicaraguan immigrants, many of whom have been living in the United States for decades. Their special immigration status will now expire January 5, 2019. The Trump administration's delayed ruling on whether to also eliminate the temporary protected status, or TPS, of more than 57,000 Hondurans. In New York City, two police officers have quit the New York Police Department after they were charged with rape, kidnapping and official misconduct. Prosecutors say former NYPD detectives Edward Martins and Richard Hall arrested an 18-year-old woman after stopping her car and finding a small amount of marijuana and a few anti-anxiety pills in her purse. The plainclothes officers handcuffed her, put her in the back of the police van. Prosecutors say Officer Martins then sat down in the back seat next to her, tightened her handcuffs, forced the teenager to give him oral sex, then pulled her pants off and raped her while she cried and begged him to stop. Prosecutors say Detective Hall watched his partner rape the teenager, then switch places with him and also forced her to perform oral sex on him. Prosecutors say the officers then drove the teenager back to Coney Island, forced her to take one of her anti-anxiety pills, instructed her to keep her mouth shut, and left her on the side of the road near a police precinct. Testing shows the DNA of both officers was found in the teenager. The former police officers are claiming the acts were consensual as their defense. Meanwhile, New York police officer Wayne Isaacs has been found not guilty on charges of murdering Delron Small in 2016. Small, who's African-American, was driving his girlfriend and two children on the 4th of July when the off-duty officer reportedly cut him off. Grainy black-and-white surveillance video shows Small, who was unarmed, approaching Officer Isaacs' car. Officer Isaacs then opens fire with his police gun within 1 second. As Small stumbles away and collapses on the street between two parked cars, Officer Isaac then gets out of his car, appears to tuck his gun into his waistband, and walks away. In response to the not guilty verdict, the family of Delron Small said they're devastated and outraged, saying, quote, "What Wayne Isaacs did that night, immediately shooting and killing our brother as he approached his car and leaving him to bleed out and die when he had so many other options, was murder in cold blood," unquote. In New York City, more than 100 people protested against billionaire Joe Ricketts' decision to shut down the news outlets Gothamist and DNA Info 1 week after the newsrooms voted to unionize.
My name's Emma Whitford. I had been at Gothamist for 2.5 years. Yeah, we voted to unionize by an incredible margin. I mean, the unit was 27 reporters and a few editors, and we voted for the union 25-2. I also think it's really important to clarify that we had not issued a single demand when this shutdown happened, and I think there was a lot of effort on behalf of management to be like, oh, because you guys want to unionize, you want to, like, bankrupt the company.
Some of the fired journalists have also launched a new media outlet, Gothamist in Exile, where they've already begun covering important local news stories, including today's elections and the NYP acquittal of NYPD officer Wayne Isaacs on charges of murdering Delron Small. And today is Election Day in the United States. People are heading to the polls to vote for mayor's ballot initiatives, special state Senate elections, and two governor's races. The Republican gubernatorial candidates Ed Gillespie of Virginia and Tim Guadagno of New Jersey have been both openly embraced President Trump and are running on anti-immigrant platforms. Their Democratic challengers, Ralph Northam of Virginia and Phil Murphy of New Jersey, are running on anti-Trump platforms. In Seattle, Washington, a special state Senate election has broken state spending records as millions of dollars have poured into the race between the Democratic candidate Mika Gingra and Republican candidate Jin-Yong Englund. If the Democrats win, they will flip the state Senate and take control of the entire Washington state government. There are significant mayoral races in Atlanta, Boston, Charlotte, Minneapolis, New Orleans, Pittsburgh, Seattle, and New York City, where Democratic Mayor Bill de Blasio is facing off against Republican candidate Nicole Malliotakis and independent candidate Bo Deedle. There are also a number of key ballot initiatives. In Maine, voters will decide whether to expand Medicaid over the opposition of the Maine governor, Paula Page. In Ohio, voters will decide whether to buck the pharmaceutical industry and force a reduction in the price of prescription drugs. And in New York, voters will decide whether to hold a constitutional convention to rewrite the state constitution. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Sutherland Springs, Texas, where on Sunday morning, an alleged shooter with a history of domestic violence fired 450 rounds at worshipers, killing 26 of them, including children, elderly people, and a pregnant woman, and wounding 20 more. This is survivor Rosanne Solis describing the attack.
I could see him. I was hiding under the benches, and I could see him, his feet, walking back and forth and through the aisles. Now, I didn't want to get shot. I don't know what to think anymore. This world is just so full of so much anger.
Shooter was a 26-year-old white man named Devin Patrick Kelly from New Braunfels, Texas. Investigators say he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound after he was chased by bystanders, one of whom was armed. Well, on Monday, Air Force officials admitted they had failed to share information about Kelly's criminal history with a U.S. law enforcement database that should have blocked him from buying a gun in the United States. Kelly was stationed at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico when he was convicted in 2012 by a court-martial on two charges of domestic assault after he repeatedly hit, kicked, and choked his wife and allegedly threatened her multiple times with loaded and unloaded firearms. He also pleaded guilty to hitting their 18-month-old stepson with such force that it broke the toddler's skull. Kelly was imprisoned for a year and then thrown out of the Air Force with a bad conduct discharge in 2014. The charges should have prohibited him from buying or owning firearms. But the Holloman Air Force Base Office of Special Investigations reportedly failed to enter Kelly's domestic conviction into the national background check system used by gun sellers. Police say Kelly went on to buy at least four guns, including the Ruger AR-556 assault-style rifle he reportedly used to massacre 26 people on Sunday. This is FBI agent Christopher Combs.
I know there's a lot of questions about the FBI NICS system and how did the person get the weapons. I can tell you that for the four purchases that he made The NICS system did their required checks, and there was no prohibitive information in the systems that we checked that say that he could not have purchased that firearm. There are three checks that are conducted. One is of NCIC, one is a criminal history check, and another one is an indices on the NICS system itself. So in all three of those databases, there was not information that we would have said was prohibitive for that man to get the firearm.
On Monday, authorities also said Kelly appears to have carried out the massacre because of a domestic dispute he had with his mother-in-law, who is a member of the First Baptist Church, but was not present on Sunday. He apparently did kill his grandmother-in-law. This is a spokesman for the Texas Department of Safety.
One thing everybody wants to know is, why did this happen? It's a senseless crime, but we can tell you that there was a domestic situation going on within this family. The suspect's mother-in-law attended this church. We know that he had made threatening texts from him. And we can't go into details about that domestic situation that is continuing to be vetted and thoroughly investigated. But we want to get that out there, that this was not racially motivated. It wasn't over religious beliefs. There was a domestic situation going on within the family.
For more on the link between domestic violence and mass shootings, we go to Baltimore, where we're joined by journalist Soraya Chimali, who covers the intersection of gender and politics, director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Can you start off by talking about this connection? I mean, more than half the mass killings over the last, 9 years, Soraya, are committed by people who engaged in domestic violence that we know of before. And then the whole issue of exactly what happened with this ex-Air Force soldier on the base, fracturing the skull of his 18-month-old stepson, repeatedly abusing, assaulting, and threatening his wife, confined to the base for a year. And then there is no record of this, so he can buy guns legally?
Amy, we see this pattern over and over again, which is one in which the incidence of domestic violence is minimized or trivialized in some ways, not considered serious enough to merit sustained public attention or the allocation of resources so that we can really understand the dynamic better. I mean, we really do know, there's absolutely no doubt, that the practice of violence within a home in an intimate setting with people that theoretically the aggressor loves opens the floodgates to public violence. And
Soraya, we're going to interrupt because there's something wrong with your mic, and we're going to get that fixed. But we want to bring in our second guest, Mariam Kaba, who is an organizer and educator who's worked on anti-domestic violence programs as well as anti-incarceration and racial justice programs since the late 80s. She is the co-founder of Survived and Punished, an organization that supports survivors of violence who've been criminalized for defending themselves. She's on the board of Critical Resistance and helped found the Chicago group We Charge Genocide. She was a member of Incite as well, Women of Color Against Violence. Mariam, it's great to have you with us and being and living here in New York. You lived in Chicago for so many decades, though grew up here. Your response to what took place on Sunday?
Well, I think, you know, first, sadness. And it's devastating that there's been such another loss, of so many lives that feels that it was pretty much preventable, you know, could have actually been prevented. So just enormous amounts of sadness, but also not surprised, because we know that most people, particularly women who are murdered in the U.S., are killed by intimate partners, and guns are usually at the root of that, often as Somalia was saying before, that there's, the home is a practice ground often for the violence that then becomes public violence. We really do tend to minimize private violence and focus on the spectacular examples of public violence. But if we don't address that private violence, then we are going to continue to see public violence in the ways that we have.
And your response to this oversight, apparently, that the military is claiming that they failed to report this history of Kelly's to the database, the national database?
Well, I think that points to the fact that it is really, really difficult to track people and to track guns in this country and the purchases of guns. I'm not surprised that the military wasn't able to, you know, continue to do what they needed to do, which was to report that he had had this conviction. It's a huge bureaucracy. People fall, you know, things fall through the cracks all the time. So this isn't surprising. It's unfortunate.
Soraya Chamali, I think we fixed your mic. You have covered this issue, both the issue of domestic violence and the issue of domestic violence in the military and how seriously this is taken. So if you can go through the steps and explain how it is possible that not only the fact that he was convicted on the base, but he was confined on the base for a year, and then there's no record, and what this means in general.
Right. I mean, I think that clearly within the context of his being confined, with his being convicted, he admitted that he had done this. What he did in his own family was taken seriously. But in the larger context of how domestic violence or other forms of gendered violence are treated in the military, I think there's a clear issue. So even if you think about the language of how he was discharged with for bad conduct. And bad conduct, honestly, it sounds as though a high school student misbehaved, right? And there are different categories of discharge based on the severity of the crime at hand or the behavior that led to the discharge. If you look at sexual violence in the military, perpetrators of sexual violence are discharged honorably far more often than victims of sexual violence. Victims of sexual violence are much more likely to be discharged involuntarily, to leave the service with a type of discharge that actually is in some ways more harmful when they return to civilian life than not. That's not the case with alleged perpetrators. And so there is this bigger question of how we treat private violence, how we treat sexual violence, how we think about gendered violence. And so the public-private divide that we're working with does us a real disservice, because we tend to aggregate this private terroristic violence in a way that seems irrelevant publicly. I mean, if you think of the fact that there are 3 women a day in the U.S. killed by an intimate partner, if that happened in one incident, and we were talking about between 20 and 25 women a week being killed in one incident, people might sit up and pay attention. But it's happening in the slow drip, drip, drip that we never really hear about.
Soraya, 3 women a day are killed in the United
States? 3 women
by their intimate partners?
Three women a day are killed in the United States by intimate partners.
Well, I want to ask you about the culture of the military. What is it in terms of your sense of what happens within the military that so many folks who come out of the military end up then involved in some of these violent incidents afterwards, especially those who were involved with domestic violence while they were attached to the military?
So I think there are several things. One is the military is an organization of hierarchy, authoritarianism, power and control. A lot of those dynamics are implicit in intimate partner violence, right? I mean, the military regulates violence. People have a place, they have a role, they have a reporting structure. And so the structure of the military itself is kind of a very intense microcosm of a mindset that we see over and over again within homes. Within homes, especially, where there is violence that's being enacted in these ways. The second thing is the military is filled with people who have incredibly stressful jobs, who are traumatized themselves by violence. And until we deal with what that means for those people themselves, I think we can't really focus in on why they're acting out in these ways when they leave the service. And so there are very high incidents of domestic violence, not only in the military, but also in our policing forces. Policing families have high rates of domestic violence. Those numbers are sort of hard to to secure, actually, but in some cases, estimates are that the rates of domestic violence among the police is 2 to 4 times the national average. And so we can't really separate those cultures of regulated violence from the unregulated violence that we see in the home.
And Mariam, I'd like to ask you about the, in terms of the general society. You know, we've heard about some attacks that are labeled as terrorist attacks. Now, this immediately is a mass killing, but we're immediately told it's as a result of a domestic problem. Somehow, that's supposed to make it less terroristic to the people, to the general public, and to the folks involved. Your sense of how the society treats these mass killings, especially those coming out of folks who were involved in domestic abuse?
Sure. Well, I think part of what we have to talk about is the fact that one of the main tricks, I think, of white supremacy is that it invisibilizes both kind of structures of violence and tries to focus mostly on individual forms of violence, right? So that when we see a situation where, for the most part, the people who are doing these mass killings are mostly young white men, the story gets told that that is a form of violence that's kind of an acceptable, normal form of violence. When people of color and others commit forms of violence, we're told and taught to see that as somehow outside of the norm of general kinds of violence, and we tend to catastrophize that, and then that also leads to certain kinds of policy responses that are intended to actually continue to oppress the groups that are very much already targeted and oppressed. So I think that that is a big aspect of this that we have to look at, that you can't look at these mass shootings without understanding also the ways in which violence is the glue that holds forms of oppression in place. And one of those forms of oppression is white supremacist kinds of forms of violence and oppression.
Sean King tweeted, "Don't worry, everybody." This was on Sunday. "Don't worry, everybody. It was a white man who slaughtered half of the church in Texas. That means everything is just fine. No terrorism."
Exactly right. And so that's the point that I'm making. I also think that we get too caught up in trying to label forms of violence as terrorism. You know, that is a state label that has a specific focus and an intent behind it that leads to catastrophic consequences for the communities that are further criminalized. And so I'd like us to really just do the thing that we need to do, which is that the inability to end violence against women, gender nonconforming people, and children is at the root of these forms of gun violence and mass shootings. Let's focus on trying to end those other forms of violence, which are themselves forms of mass violence.
And in the political climate that we have today, where clearly nothing is going to happen at the national level on this issue of guns, what do you see as the road that people concerned about this issue must take?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to look at be much more creative in the way that we address issues. I tend to be skeptical of gun control in general. I see it often as a way to criminalize communities of color further. But there are things that people are offering, like disarming domestic abusers, which would mean we have to disarm a lot of people in the military, as you just talked about, and in the police structure as well. We should also look at personal liability. We should look at the things that could happen at the state level that might, you know, help reduce the number of people who are harmed and killed by gun violence.
You know, as President Trump is in Japan, he was there on Sunday. He immediately responded as he was pushing billions of dollars of weapons to the Japanese government. He immediately responded by saying, "This is not the time to talk about gun control."
Of course.
And yet, when what happened in New York happened just a few days ago, mm-hmm. he immediately talked about dropping the special immigration program.
Absolutely.
I wanted to quote filmmaker Michael Moore, who tweeted Monday, "As of yesterday, Columbine is no longer one of the 10 worst mass shootings in U.S. history. 3 of the top 5 are all in the last year and a half." And so this issue of solutions that Juan just raised, Saraya Chamale, talk about what is and isn't happening in Congress. I mean, I think if you ask most people after the Las Vegas killing, where this white 64-year-old man gunned down 59 people, injured over 500, when Paddock did this, there was this discussion of making illegal bump stocks, right? This what makes it possible for a semi-automatic weapon to shoot as an automatic weapon. I think most people in this country think they were made illegal immediately. Even the NRA said they would be okay with that, though they wanted it to be a rule, not voted by Congress, because then it could be turned around pretty quickly. But in fact, even that didn't happen, though they are now saying that they will look at that, given this latest massacre.
I mean, I think that there's no doubt that we don't have the political will in Congress to pass even the most basic forms of legislation. And I want to go back to something that Marianne said, which is the way that white supremacy works. And there's a particular issue with gun control in terms of risk perception and risk assessment. And this is a long-studied phenomenon. In the U.S., it's called the white male effect. And what it's related to is the different ways in which people assess risk based on threats to their own identity. And so when you look at the Congress and the way it approaches questions like climate change, environmental degradation, gun control, abortion, what you end up with in terms of policy is a very distorted sense of what the risks are, what the costs are, that's directly related to our lack of inclusivity, diversity, and to the very real representation or misrepresentation of the population at large, because we have a Congress that is over 80% white and over 80% male. And so 20 years of studies show that conservative white men are outliers in terms of risk assessment, and that the ways in which the rest of us might look at problems in society just are different for them. And so we need to really realize that the way is in which politically we're represented matter deeply to the resolution of these problems. And in terms of gun control, it just doesn't strike this group of people that are leading our country as dangerous or as risky as it does for the people who are being killed and hurt and penalized on a daily basis. And I think that we need to speak directly to that as a function of who our leaders are. And why it's important to vote, and why it's important to understand that we need much, much, much more robustly diverse representation in all stages of government, so that we don't have these kinds of outlier risk assessments that are truly debilitating to us as a society.
Miriam, as we begin to wrap up, you heard the headlines. You heard the story of the two New York police officers who have now quit, the allegations that they raped this young woman who they handcuffed and brought into their car. You've worked on these issues of police brutality in Chicago, now in New York. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, I think, one of the issues that becomes really clear when we widen our lens to include particularly young people and particularly women and gender nonconforming people in the conversation of police violence is that we see a lot of sexual violence being done against people, as a way of kind of controlling them and also kind of continuing that threat that if you go forward and you let anybody know that this happened, we're going to come after you. So the forms of violence become much broader. So you then see that that is possible. So many women and gender nonconforming people have complained over the years of police sexual violence. It is probably more people are harmed that way than are killed by the police every single year. And yet we hardly ever include that within the larger discussion around police violence. We have to. Andrea Ritchie's new book, Invisible No More, that just came out a couple of months ago, addresses violence against Black women and women of color, as well as gender nonconforming people. I suggest that people who are interested in these topics pick that up and read it. I happen to have written the foreword for that book, so, I have to put that out there. And so I think that we have to look at these issues. We have to look at the inherent endemic violence of policing. And I think people don't want to do that. I think people are constantly focused on small little fixes, body cameras and things like that. That is not going to stop sexual violence by the police officers. And I, last thing I do want to say about this is I saw yesterday on Twitter, Harsha Walia did this amazing piece where she talked about, for several tweets, that, you know, gender violence and gendered violence is mass violence in and of itself. It is an epidemic in and of itself. It is not a warning sign of future forms of violence. And the conversation that's being had right now, it troubles me because I don't think we're going to get to a solution unless we treat domestic and sexual violence as mass violence in and of itself, and that we address those head on, and that we make sure we understand that they're co-constitutive of other forms of violence, white supremacy, other forms of oppression. We have got to get at the root. Otherwise, we're not going to solve this problem.
I mean, it is interesting that police officers understand when they go into a domestic violence situation, it's the most dangerous situation for them.
Right.
And at the same time, sadly, police officers have a higher rate of domestic violence in their own families.
Exactly right. And I think, you know, Soraya mentioned that it was 2 to 4 times more likely than the general public of being perpetrators of domestic violence. Police officers are, and people in the military as well. But we shouldn't be shocked by that, right? Those are forms of violence in and of themselves. Policing is, the military, the war making, and violence is learned, right? And so in those contexts, of course, people who are exposed to violence all the time will use it. It also attracts people who are particularly interested in being able to practice forms of violence at home that they then take out into the public sphere. And here we are.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for joining us. Mariam Kaba is organizer and educator who's worked on anti-domestic violence programs for decades, as well as anti-incarceration and racial justice programs since the late 80s. And Soraya Chamali, a journalist who covers the intersection of gender and politics. We'll link to your work, director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. She's speaking to us from Baltimore. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the great writer Isabel Allende has a new book. It's called In the Midst of Winter. We'll talk to her about her book. We'll talk to her about writing in the era of Trump. She came to this country from, well, throughout Latin America, in Chile. She grew up. And we'll talk about how she responded to the coming authoritarianism of the Pinochet regime. And also Pablo Neruda, the latest investigation of how he died soon after another September 11th, 1973. What happened to the great Chilean poet? Stay with us.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no rights. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empires fall. Freedom is merely privilege extended unless enjoyed by one and all. Son and brothers and sisters, for the struggle carries on. The international knowledge unites the world in song. So
The Internationale, performed by Billy Bragg, today marks the 100th anniversary of the start of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we spend the rest of the hour with Isabel Allende, one of the Latin America's and the United States' greatest novelists. She's the author of 23 books, including The House of the Spirits, Paula, Daughter of Fortune. Her latest is a novel titled In the Midst of Winter, a love story that still manages to explore the issues of human rights and the plight of immigrants and refugees. Her books have been translated into 35 languages, sold over 57 million copies around the world. Isabel Allende now lives in California. She was born, though, in Peru in 1942 and traveled the world as the daughter of a Chilean diplomat. Her father's first cousin was Salvador Allende, Chile's president from 1970 until the September 11th, 1973 coup when Augusto Pinochet seized power in a CIA-backed military coup. Salvador Allende died in the palace that day. Isabel Allende would later flee from her native Chile to Venezuela.
Chile's Museum of Memory and Human Rights recently opened a new exhibit documenting the United States' intervention in the coup. Secrets of the State, the Declassified History of the Chilean Dictatorship, features declassified documents from the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, National Security Council, Federal Bureau of Investigation, White House and State Department. This is the museum director, Javier Estevez.
These documents speak. They speak of everything that was the CIA operation in its moment in 1970, with the knowledge of Nixon and Henry Kissinger to keep Allende from assuming the presidency of the republic. This is a drama. It really touched the whole world. And of course, you cannot understand how a country like the United States participated so openly in a military coup like the one that happened in Chile.
We are joined by Isabel Allende in our studio. It's great to have you back with
us.
It's
always great to be here.
So,
hello, Juan.
How are you?
We have a lot to talk about. You have a new book out, In the Midst of Winter, which actually is based here in New York, in Brooklyn, to be exact. But we also wanted to talk, since we haven't spoken on the show since President Trump came to power, I actually wanted to start not here in the U.S., but in Chile. On another September 11th, 1973, you were there in Chile, in your country. Describe what happened and how you saw your country change.
Well, Chile had been the longest and most solid democracy in the continent. And we elected a socialist president that represented a coalition of parties of the left and the center, Salvador Allende. And immediately the CIA and the forces of the right in my country tried to stop him from becoming the president. But eventually that was impossible, and he assumed the presidency in 1970. And the next 3 years were years of political, social, and economic crisis in Chile, because the government was sabotaged by the right and by foreign forces as well. The CIA intervened, and Allende denounced that many times. Nobody believed it, because it was like the story of the bad wolf, you know. The CIA was always blamed for everything in Latin America. The worst thing that you could say to any Latin American is, oh, he's an agent of the CIA. Yeah, that's like the worst insult. And so on September 11th, also a Tuesday, 1973, we had been hearing that there could be a coup, but we didn't know what that was. We had never had that. We woke up to the sound of helicopters and airplanes and tanks in the streets. People who didn't have time to hear the news didn't stay home, and so there were workers in the streets waiting for buses that never came. I went to tried to get to my office, and the office was closed.
What were you doing then?
I was a journalist, and the building was closed, was locked, and the streets were empty, except for the military tanks and trucks. So during that day, it was all just rumors. We didn't know what was going on. But I saw the bombing of the presidential palace, El Palacio de la Moneda. And we could not believe it. It is as if the armed forces in the United States would bomb the White House. I mean, it's something that we can hardly imagine. And then in a matter of 24 hours, the Congress was dismissed. All political parties were declared illegal. There was no free press, no public opinion, therefore. All institutions were banned. All forms of communication and gathering, except the Catholic Church, that actually played a very important role in defending the people who were victims of repression. Everybody in Chile, me included, thought that this was a sort of historical accident, and in a couple of weeks, maybe, the military would call elections and we would go back to democracy. In the minds of everybody was the idea that the president would be possibly Eduardo Frei, who was a Christian Democrat and was a very conservative man, and that would probably be the option.
Your cousin Salvador Allende had died in the palace.
He had died in the coup. And so that was something that was in the air. But of course, that was not the plan of the military. They had done this to be in power, and they stayed in power for 17 years. The first few years were of brutal repression. Then the repression became much more targeted. So it wasn't as if anybody just could be arrested in the office, as it was at the beginning, or in the street, or at home. It was very targeted. By then, I was out. I had left my country. And so that is what happened. And it's only much later that, after Pinochet left and we have democracy, that all this information about how things happened has come up.
Well, and still information is coming out. The news recently about Pablo Neruda, probably the most famous at that point, the most famous Chilean in the world, in terms of the findings that the Nobel laureate Neruda did not die of cancer in 1973, as stated on his death certificate. And he died just a couple of weeks after the coup, and bolstering claims that Neruda was poisoned under General Pinochet's rule. And Neruda has driver has claimed he was poisoned by a stomach injection administered by doctors. Neruda won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1971. He was a close friend of the ousted President Allende, but now forensic experts say they'll need up to a year to determine the true cause of Neruda's death. Your reaction to this?
One of the reasons to suspect is because Eduardo Frei was killed the same way, in a very mysterious way. He went to the same clinic and mysteriously died of a sudden bad development of a minor surgery. And now it's been proven that he was poisoned. And so the suspicion is that the same happened to Neruda, because if Neruda would have lived, he would have gone into exile. The same day of the coup, every country in the world was offering asylum to Pablo Neruda. There were telegrams coming from everywhere offering to take him out of the country and give him a home somewhere else. So he would have been a voice against the dictatorship, a voice against the military. And it's very possible that they decided to eliminate him, as they eliminated people here in Washington as well. Letelier was assassinated in Washington.
In 1976.
So that is a possibility, but it has not been proven. So I cannot really talk about it. I don't know anything more than you do.
Can you talk, though, about the significance of who Pablo Neruda was?
Pablo Neruda was our national poet. To give you an idea of the impact of his poetry, Pablo Neruda was the candidate for the presidency right before Allende was. We don't have primaries in Chile, but at the time, the idea was that Allende had been a candidate in three previous elections, and he was sort of cursed. He was never going to be president. He would make the joke that in his tomb it would say, "Here lies the future president of Chile." So it was a joke, really. And so they decided to have Pablo Neruda as a candidate for the left because he was known everywhere. And he did he traveled the country in a train, and the train would stop in stations, and the people would gather, and the people would recite back to him his poetry in a choir. And this was coal miners, fishermen, workers in the country. So that's how the impact he had. And
were you at his funeral?
Of course, I was at his funeral. Very few people could go because he died. He died on September 22nd, 11 days after the coup, when all his people from his party, he belonged to the Communist Party, people from the left, friends, intellectuals, journalists were either arrested or hiding somewhere. It was very hard to show up. But I went, and I remember that the ambassador of Sweden was there, a very tall man in a long black coat. And I just stood behind him, holding on to his coat, and I thought, no one is going to shoot him. because there were soldiers with machine guns along the road all the way to the cemetery. And at the beginning, the procession was in silence. And then at some point, a worker in a construction building, shouted, "Compañero Pablo Neruda," and everybody responded, "Presente." And then somebody else shouted, "Compañero Salvador Allende," and we all shouted, "Presente." So the funeral of the poet became a sort of symbolic funeral of democracy.
We're going to go to a break, then come back to talk about your latest book, In the Midst of Winter. Our guest is the great writer Isabel Allende. Stay with us.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio dos lucecos que cuando los abro perfecto distingo lo negro del blanco, y en el alto cielo su fondo brillado, en las multitudes el hombre que yo amo. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el oído, que en todo su ancho graba noche y día, grillos y canarios, martillos, turbinas, ladrillos, chubascos.
Gracias a la vida, Thanks to Life, by Chilean musician and composer Violeta Parra. Our guest knew her in Chile. Yes, our guest is Isabel Allende, the great best-selling Chilean writer, one of Latin America's most renowned novelists, as well as novelists in the United States. Her latest book is called In the Midst of Winter. Let's turn to a passage from the book. When Isabel Allende describes the working relationship that Evelyn Ortega, the young undocumented immigrant from Guatemala, has with her employers, the Leroys.
Allende writes, quote, "Evelyn did not have fixed hours in their house. She, in theory, worked from 9 to 5, but in practice spent the whole day with the child she was looking after and even slept next to him so that she could attend to him if need be. In other words, she worked the equivalent of three normal shifts. According to Richard and Lucia's calculations, she was paid much less in cash than she was entitled to. To them, it seemed like forced labor or slavery. But this did not matter to Evelyn. More important was that she had somewhere to live and was safe." That is from Isabel Allende's new novel, In the Midst of Winter. And you bring together these characters, one from Guatemala, undocumented from Guatemala, one from a Brazil family, although originally from Europe, and one from Chile, Lucia.
Yeah, three unlikely characters that are stuck in a dangerous situation during a snowstorm in Brooklyn. So it's a very, for 3 days, it's a very contained story. But then I have flashbacks to the stories of each one of them. And each one have been traumatized by things of the past. In the case of Lucia, by the political events in her country, in Chile in the 70s. In the case of Evelyn Ortega, the Guatemalan undocumented refugee, because she's escaping from the gangs and the horrible situation in her country. Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador are the triangle of the north, the places in the world that are not at war, where there's most violence, more violence than anywhere else. And people are escaping from the narcos, the gangs, corruption, poverty, inefficient government. And she's also escaping for her life because she's a victim of the gangs. And in the case of Richard, the American professor at NYU, who has a perfectly safe life, he's vegan, he has four cats, it seems that nothing can happen to him. He also has a bad past that haunts him. And there's a quote at the beginning of the book that gives the title to the book, and it says, "In the midst It's a quote by Albert Camus. In the midst of winter, I finally found in me an invincible summer. And that's the whole point of the book. And I think it's timely because we all go through winters in our lives, sometimes very long winters. And we have to remember that there is an invincible summer waiting to emerge. Sometimes that happens to nations, to countries, to the world. I mean, I was born in one of the longest winters in the middle of the Second World War. And I have seen in my life many moments of great crisis in which it seemed that the world was never going to recover from what was happening. But it does. I'm very optimistic. So now that we feel, many people feel in this country, that we are in a political winter that might last 4 years, and if we are unlucky, maybe 8, we have to remember that under the surface, the summer is there, and there are forces that will make it happen.
I was particularly struck. There was one scene in the novel, and we don't want to give away too much of it, so obviously for people to buy it and read it. But when the coyote, who is bringing Evelyn from Guatemala up through Mexico, Berto Cabrera says, brings all these people who he is, who's guiding through across the border to pray.
Yeah,
and he says, we are pilgrims in a church without borders. Just the image of a coyote gathering together with everyone to pray really brought a smile to my face.
I didn't invent it. I saw it. Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's, in this case, the coyote was linked somehow to the evangelicals. So there's a whole...
What do you mean saw it?
Well, I didn't see it personally. I saw it in a video mm-hmm. that someone had taken. And the coyote had gathered his group, and they were all praying. He gives them the instructions because they have to cross Mexico. And he says to them, from now on, you are all Mexican. So he tells them the words that they cannot say, the Guatemalan voz, for example, you cannot say in Mexico, how you have to treat the authority. And because... Evelyn Ortega is so, he thinks, so dumb that she will not learn how to pass for a Mexican. He says, you will be mute, and so you don't speak. I'm taking you to a nun school where they treat the deaf and the mute. Those stories, I don't have to make them up. They are real. There's a book that I totally recommend, and I should have read it before I wrote my book, but I didn't know it existed. It's a book by Luis Alberto Urrea, and it's called The Devil's Highway, in which it tells the story of 14 people who died in the desert of thirst and heat, but mostly all the infrastructure that sustains the smuggling of human beings, the trafficking of human beings. Why people leave? Because nobody wants to leave what is familiar to them unless they are desperate. And why... And who are the people who make it possible? The crime organization that sustains all this.
And though you didn't write this in the age of Trump, you start all your books on January 8th. You're now traveling in the age of Trump as you talk about the book. And, of course, you've lived here. Your feelings today, I was thinking about you describing September 11th in Chile as your country changed. Do you see any similarities?
No. I see the fascist forces have been in this country and in my country always, because Trump doesn't invent anything. He picks up what is already there. Pinochet would not have been possible for 17 years without the support of a third of the population that thought that it was much better to live under a repressive government and don't have any urban crime than have democracy and have free will and all the things that we take for granted. When I came to this country 30 years ago, I told Willie, who was then the man I loved, I said, I'm scared. This country has this fascist element that I'm so scared of. I ran away from that. And he said, are you crazy? This is the cradle of democracy. And I said, yeah, but people have this sense that they are superior, that they can teach the world how to live, how to govern themselves. Half the population is armed. There is the idea of white supremacy, a latent fascination with violence. We don't want violence in our lives, but we are fascinated with the violence of football, of war, of the video games, of movies. We want to live it vicariously. And then when it happens, like in the church a few days ago, then we are horrified. But our kids grow up with it.
We're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Isabel Allende, the great writer, has written a new book. It's called In the Midst of Winter. Happy birthday to John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining me. No, can we...